You probably saw that heartbreaking press release from UNICEF earlier this week. No words will do justice to the children killed, it said. Their mothers, their fathers and their loved ones. And the rest of the page was blank. With an accompanying explanation, we no longer have the words to describe children's suffering and our outrage. Do those inflicting the suffering still have words to describe their barbaric acts? So, what provoked such a gesture? The return of full hostilities to Syria, that's what. With more than 400 people killed in Assad government attacks on the rebel-held Damascus suburb of Ghouta, in what was described as one of the bloodiest 24-hour periods of Syria's seven-year civil war. It was hoped, perhaps naively, that with Daesh or IS more or less defeated, that some kind of peace would eventuate. Instead, the civil war that had been somewhat sidelined has now roared back into barbarousness and is as complex as it ever was. And you might have seen that a vote in the UN overnight for a 30-day ceasefire failed when Russia voted no, and they were expected to vote again, but that has also been postponed. We've invited a specialist observer to join us, Roger Shanahan from the West Asia program at the Lowy Institute, to attempt an itemised overview, as it were, to tease out some of the key contests in this war, hopefully to provide us with some clarity about this epic drama, fully conscious that we Australians are mercifully unused to such complexity. Good morning, Roger.
Yeah, good morning.
Were we so busy thinking about IS that we forgot there was a civil war going on there?
Well, perhaps in a popular imagination, but I think for most people, they understood that there was a much broader conflict still going on. It tampered down to a degree, but the Syrian government and the Russians, for instance, were quite happy for the United States to support Kurdish forces in the northeast to concentrate on Islamic State because it meant that they didn't have to take care of that problem. But I think people should never have been under any false illusion that this civil war and the fundamentals that were driving it were continued regardless of whether Islamic State were there or not.
So what do we fundamentally need to understand about this renewed phase of the war? Is it different, do you think, to the others?
It's not different fundamentally, but what we're seeing now is after Islamic State and the focus on Islamic State has been taken away, we're back to what was really the rump civil war and different external parties jockeying for position in the post or trying to create the conditions for the best outcome for them in a post-civil war Syria. But we're still a long way from that post-civil war stage.
That's your view, is it?
I think there's the diplomatic side is relatively intractable at the moment. In order to get people to the negotiating table and be serious about the outcome, I think one side has to have reached a fundamentally superior position militarily on the ground. And the reality is that the Syrian government has the momentum, but it can't generate enough combat power to have that kind of dominant military position that would allow it to dictate events at the negotiating table.
So let's get to some of the specifics of this war, which is what I'm going to try to do in the next 12 minutes or whatever it is. 2 weeks ago, an Israeli F-16 was shot down by Syrian anti-aircraft defences, which came as a huge shock to the Israelis because they haven't lost an aircraft to enemy action since 1982. So let's look at Israel and at the moment. Where does it sit in this brew?
Well, I think to start with, it was given the nature of the way the Syrian civil war morphed in the early stages, with a quite hard Islamist edge to it. In the early phases, it was willing to sit back and, in its best outcome, hope that Assad could survive, but also have a fallback position of working out who it could work with in the event that Assad didn't survive. And I think that was probably a valid policy to have at the time. What's happened since then is Iran has strengthened its hand in Syria, and I think this Israelis believe that this represents a potential existential threat to it.
Coming closer to it.
Correct, to its northern border. And what it spent most of its time, particularly in discussions with the Russians, is trying to broker some kind of agreement of keeping Iranian or Iranian-backed forces as far away as possible from Israel's northern border. And when they do come within an undisclosed red line, then they reach out with air power and attack Iranian-backed militias, which we've seen numerous times in the past. So at the moment, Israel's focus is really keeping Iranian interests and presence as far away from its northern border as possible.
Okay, so let's look at Iran. Israel says Iran is to blame. So what's Iran's role here?
Well, Iran's seen an opportunity relatively early on in the Syrian civil war to extend its influence in the region. People are conflating the notion of some kind of religious affiliation with the Alawis in Syria. They're really essentially two different religions for all intents and purposes. So this is really geopolitics on a regional scale. Iran has seen an opportunity to try and prop up a long-term ally, and not only prop it up, but also change the power relationship between the two. Under Bashar Assad's father, Hafez, he had an alliance, an informal alliance with the Iranians, but there was no doubt that he was in control of that relationship in Syria. Because of the weakness of the Bashar al-Assad regime, that power dynamic has shifted, and it's very difficult to say where it is at the moment, but certainly the Iranians are much more influential in Syria at the moment than they were prior to the civil war.
Well, let's talk about the group that is always believed, certainly the Israelis believe, the Iranians play through, as it were, the Hezbollah, the armed Islamist group now playing a very significant role in government in Lebanon. So where do they sit in this?
Well, quite early on, because of the weakness of the Syrian regime and the activities of Islamist groups in particular close to the Lebanese border, Hezbollah groups were deployed from within Lebanon to Syria, in western Syria, close to the Lebanese border, undisclosed. But in 2013, Hezbollah came public with the fact that they were operating within Syria. Best estimates at the moment is that Hezbollah has lost several hundred, perhaps in the order of 1,000 people over the past 6 years in fighting in Syria. But they're only one leg of Iranian, pro-Iranian Shia militia that are operating inside Syria. What Iran has tried to do is try to lower the direct cost to it and have fewer Iranian troops and have more pro-Iranian militias like Lebanese Hezbollah. You also find Afghan and Pakistani and Iraqi Shia militia groups operating inside Syria but under Iranian command.
Now, Hezbollah, as from what we understand, has gained substantial operational experience in Syria. The Center for 21st Century Security Intelligence says that they effectively knit together a number of violent non-state actors in support of the Iranians of their expeditionary mission to prop up Assad. And they go on to say it is hard to find an actor in the region who hasn't been impressed by Hezbollah's performance in the Syrian war, which must strike even more fear into the Israelis.
Certainly. I think I suppose there's two ways of looking at this. On the one hand, certainly Hezbollah has gained a great deal of operational experience. And in the early phases of the war in particular, Hezbollah was used as probably the assault force in the more difficult areas because they were more capable than many of the Syrian main force units. On the other hand, they've lost a relatively significant number of mid-ranking commanders. But like any military-style organisation, you always replace losses. So overall, you would have to say that Hezbollah is much more operationally capable. But at the same time, when I travel in the region, you hear some talk about Hezbollah operatives who have done multiple tours in Syria not wanting to go back after a period of time because they suffer combat fatigue, same as everybody else suffers combat fatigue. So it's not all Hezbollah is not some kind of homogenous organisation that acts the same, has all of its actors acting in the same way in the future. But without doubt, they're much more capable organisation post-Syrian civil war than they were prior to it.
Could we talk about the Kurds? Because they seem to be very wedged, is what I'd put it. How would you describe their position?
Well, one always feels a degree of sympathy for the Kurds because they're always caught between a rock and a hard place. They want to assert their Kurdish national aspirations, and they will always have. They're always in a very weak bargaining position. So people have other external actors have a transactional relationship with them because they are good fighters. They're quite disciplined. They're moderate in terms of religious identity. But in reality, there is no stomach amongst any of the actors inside or certainly outside Syria to advance any notion of Kurdish nationalism. So US forces are backing Syrian Kurds in northeastern Syria. They've made them much more militarily capable, but that is, and the US has been pretty open about it, that is a tactical arrangement. There is no notion that going forward, long-term in the future, that the US is going to back any kind of autonomy or national identity for the Kurds. The problem in Syria is that Kurds have been perhaps a victim of their own success. In the northeast, they've benefited from US fire support, training and logistics support, but at the same time, they've been very effective in northern Syria. Now, those two areas aren't connected, but unfortunately for the Kurds, because they've been so successful in northern Syria, that's brought them up to the border of Turkey, and that's a real red line for President Erdogan. And what we're seeing at the moment now is President Erdogan's incursion into northern Syria and fighting the Kurdish groups in Afrin. He's sending a message to the Kurds in the northeast and the US that there are certain red lines that the Turkish government is not going to allow, and one of them is any notion of Turkish regional autonomy.
So what about Turkey? Turkey seems to always, to me, have a quite confused foreign policy.
Yes, I think that's a pretty good way of putting it. I think one of the things we see in the region, and President Erdogan is no different to many of the others, they're excellent domestic politicians. They understand their constituency very, very well. They're authoritarian. They kind of drive or drive through approach to their domestic political agenda works domestically. But when they try and translate that into foreign policy, external actors don't act in the same way that domestic actors do. So oftentimes they're not worldly enough to understand that for every action there is a reaction in international relations. And we've seen that time and again, I think, in Turkish foreign policy towards Syria. And I think we have to remember it's not Turkish foreign policy. This is Erdogan policy towards Syria, not only when he's prime minister, but now that he's president. He, like many of the other regional leaders, thought that Assad would fall quite quickly. So he backed, he tried to have as much influence and backed a number of actors in the early stages of the uprising. The problem then became when Assad was able to survive with the help first of the Iranians and later of the Russians. What do you do now? There was never any plan B for the Turks. That once support for these groups didn't result in the fall of Assad, what do you do
now?
He's
not a chess player, is he?
No, he's not. He's a very short-term tactical domestic politician. He's not a strategist.
And of course, we must note that there were three journalists sentenced to life in prison during the week. They lock up more journalists than any other country. And there was that extraordinary result for the three journalists. One was freed, but three locked up for life. Okay, Russia.
Yeah, so when you look at all the actors, you have to understand, I think, when you're looking at the Syrian civil war, what kind of leverage do countries have and what kind of interests do countries have in Syria? The reality is, for the United States, it never really had much leverage. It doesn't have historical connections of much depth with Syria. Russia, on the other hand, has been an ally for half a century of Syria. It's got significant business interests and has had significant business interests. The depth of contacts that it's had with Syria, much deeper than any of the other European players. So, and it believes that in the future, Russia will have a role to play in Syria. It's signed longer-term contracts for its naval base at Tartus. It's established an airbase now, which it's also extended its lease on as well. So Russia is there for the long term. I think when they made the decision to enter in 2015, we saw that took a lot of the regional countries by surprise, and we saw an immediate fillip to Syrian efforts. Momentum shifted towards the Syrian government, and it has maintained that momentum. But I think Russia, a bit like Iran, has wanted to be involved, but not decisively engaged, so that they could never get out. So they've tipped the balance, but they haven't tipped it sufficiently to change the dynamics to a degree where they can get a political solution. And Russia, like everybody else, understands the only solution to this is a political one.
And we've sort of covered the Assad government tactics. Oh, Roger, that was a tour de force as far as I'm concerned. Thank you very much indeed for
My
joining
pleasure.
Us. My pleasure. Roger Shanahan from the Lowy Institute.